Join us this week as Yes Ad's keyboard legend, Rick Wakeman. Chris and Bill dive into a sea of polyrhythms. Steve plays 5,000 instruments. And John keeps singing about eagles. This week, Yes's 1971 album, Fragile. Welcome back to A Sort of Young Person's Guide to Prog Rock. I am your host, Ian Prize. Today, we rejoin Yes, which include the lead singer John Anderson, bassist Chris Squire, guitarist Steve Howe, and drummer Bill Bruford, only 9 months after they released the Yes album. So Yes had their hit, but all was not perfect in the band. Creative differences between John and Chris and the keyboardist Tony Kaye would see his exit from the band and the recruitment of the prog legend and probably prog's biggest superstar, Rick Wakeman. So Rick Wakeman had been trained as a piano player in his youth and was now debating a career as a studio musician. Yes was getting bigger and more ambitious and felt they needed someone passionate about the newest technology to see their ambitions realized. Rick, who had just been offered the spot to join David Bowie's backing band, decided he would rather forge a new path with Yes rather than just be in someone's backing band. And so, in 1971, Yes would convene and record Fragile. So for this album, Yes would play 4 group compositions, interspersed with 5 solo compositions, which would show off the musical talents of each member. This album would debut that classic Yes sound, with Rick and Steve trading licks, the rhythm section of Chris and Bill playing intricate and controlled bursts, and John Anderson's soaring vocals and mysterious, mystical lyrics floating above it all. It would also spawn their first hit song, Roundabout, a 7-minute topographical tale which would function as a calling card and signature song for both Yes and prog rock in general. And this is truly an album where 1970s prog rock is firing on all cylinders. So this album is now the beating heart of prog and it has all the elements I'm personally into prog for, and this album in particular is just extremely fun. So Roundabout is a classic rock staple for a reason. And even though I've heard it so much, I've enjoyed coming back to it all for this podcast with fresh ears. But the real winner for me has always been the ending track, Heart of the Sunrise. It has the crazy lyrics, the crazy singing, the instrumentals, multi-parted song structure. It's all just so unbelievably Yes. So here to discuss Fragile with me, I'm joined by Yes royalty. I'm joined by the Pharaoh of fusion jazz, Ryan Robison.
How on earth did I get promoted to Pharaoh?
Well, even more surprising is the Augustus of Adult Alternative, Nick Osmussen.
Hi, Ian. Thanks. I'm happy to be here.
And then, of course, holding down the fort is the Jarl of Yacht Rock, Brian Gann.
That's an impressive J-Y rhyming scheme you had there. I'm very impressed.
That was off the cuff. So, welcome all of you. Here we are to discuss Fragile. So, we'll start with you, Brian. What are your just initial thoughts on Fragile?
You know, I think it's pretty easy to argue that the Yes album is the start of the classic Yes sound, but I almost think Fragile is the true beginning of the Golden Age in the same way that Dark Side shortly comes after Metal. Yep. Which Metal introduced that sound, and then Dark Side kind of perfected it, and you kind of get 3 perfect albums from there.
Yeah, I would agree. And that's the stretch we're on, is that crystallizing the perfect sound. Nick, what are your thoughts on Fragile?
I do really enjoy this album because, like it has already been stated, like this is them at their peak. And most bands at their peak, I'll listen to. But this one, I liked.
That's good. That's good to hear. Yeah. And did you have a relationship to Roundabout? Had it been something you'd heard on classic rock radio?
Definitely. At the pizza place where Brian, Ryan, and I used to work, it was frequently on Block Party Weekend, which, for those out of the know, is where they play multiple songs in a row by the same artist. And for the Yes block, almost always Roundabout was part of that couplet or triplet. So I have spent many an hour topping pizzas, tossing them in the oven while listening to Roundabout.
I'm assuming they didn't play 5% for nothing on the block party. Ryan, What is your relationship to Fragile?
This is one of the ones that actually does make it back into my high school years. I think my thoughts are pretty similar to Brian's, though. It's the kicking off of a very classic era. I mean, you do hear previews of it on the S album. You know, you think Starship Trooper, yeah. Some of the other cuts like that. It kind of tells you where they're going. This one in particular, too, I think even more than Close to the Edge or anything that comes after that, has a pretty collaborative aspect to it where everybody got their hands and put their little stink on everything at some point or another. And I mean that in a really good way. And they actually, this is the only album where they really do that. While Close to the Edge is still my favorite, this has it's got a lot more variety just because of who was allowed to write and when, I think. And I say allowed because it sounds kind of funny, like someone was the dictator of the group, but yeah, it's unique in that way, and it stands out from the others.
You are right in so much as Chris Squire is still contributing writing stuff for this album in a big way. And then obviously they all get a solo spot on the album. So that makes this a very special and fun album and an album structure I don't think I've ever heard of from any other band. So I guess I would reiterate everything you guys have said. And I think this album really cashes in on the delights of Prague. So you get lots of stuff going on, but cleanly and pleasantly. And then in terms of an album structure, just the Sandwich album, we have Roundabout and Heart of the Sunrise is a delicious ciabatta on the outside, and a little Southside gabagool right in the middle, and then a little bit of cheeses and pickles throughout. And I do think, like, in that sense, it's a very pleasant album construction, and certainly it's a good taster album construction.
Superficially, I think, you know, the reason why we've had this kind of distinctive sound is the obvious addition of Rick Wakeman, but also on that superficial trend, the Roger Dean album cover. It finally looks like Yes.
Yes.
You know, the golden capes are flowing. I think we'll get into the music, but I think those are the obvious ones. We're at what I think most Yes fans would consider the kind of golden era, the band.
Yeah.
Those five members.
I think we've got the five members. As you say, this album is the story kind of Rick Wakeman joining, and we'll definitely get to the album cover, but you're right. I think that adds that last little bit of like metaphysical magic.
So to cycle back around to something that you said before, is that everybody takes a turn in the spotlight on this one. Are there bands that have four songwriters in them, and why aren't there more of them? I know the Beatles is the obvious choice, but like, are there any others?
That's an interesting one. I mean, I'm not that I can think of off the top of my head.
I guess maybe the Traveling Wilburys or something, like super
yeah,
groups.
I genuinely think that's probably about it. Because I was going to say, I think even Yes didn't really have five songwriters. They had John Anderson and Steve Howe mainly, some Chris Squire, Rick Wakeman for a bit of spice, and then Bill Bruford obviously exerted some sort of creative influence on the music, but I don't think he was bringing in songs in the same way John Anderson and Steve Howe were. You know, I guess again with the Beatles, there's only, I think, 20 George Harrison songs in a career of 200 songs.
And man, did he get a lot of mileage out of those.
I wanted to think of an example of where the taster doesn't go well, right? Where everyone gets a little crack it, writing a little something. And I think of times when it doesn't go well, like Amagama, for example.
Yeah.
Where everyone really didn't need to contribute, but they did anyway. So Yes did something special here.
Absolutely.
There's a lot of examples where everybody took a turn at something at some point. But yeah, Nick, I can't think of any examples. I'm sure there'll be plenty of email telling me how wrong I am, where regularly everyone took in kind of an equal share of the songwriting. I can't think of a single one.
Oh, I have got exactly one. Queen.
Really?
Was that consistent though? I mean, I know the famous like bar trivia fact is every member of Queen wrote a number one hit, which that is pretty impressive.
Yeah, that is very impressive.
I don't know how many John Deacon songs there are other than that one.
Yeah, so he had three, and those are the only three songs he ever wrote, but they were all number one hits. But yeah, no, Queen, as far as it goes, did pretty well, each contributing a song.
Yeah.
Great track record.
Made it count.
Now I'm sure all the Queen people are going to send us hate mail. It's going to be like that scene from Mr. Smith Goes to Washington of just bags and bags of letters hating us.
Brian, finally getting hauled in front of Congress, having to defend Queen.
I want Peter Morgan, who, you know, he's done like The Crown and a lot of the dramas and things around the world. He wrote Bohemian Rhapsody, but I would love his take on Yes. That is something I would watch.
We talked about this in the middle episode, but Brian's getting his own biopic. But to the soundtrack of Yes, he's getting his own jukebox musical. Fabulous. So we are diving in to the roundabout. So roundabout is their 7-minute kickoff to this album. So roundabout was written on the tour bus as they drove through Scotland. So they came over the crest of a hill and mountains rose out of the sky and all that. And I think that really highlights something I love about John's lyrics and how he ties places and terrains to something metaphysical. I don't know what the something is, but it feels nice.
Is there a better introduction to Rick Wakeman than the song? I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Ian, the reason Tony K kind of got forced out is he didn't want to adapt the sound to the new mellotrons and synthesizers of the world, and he wanted to stick to organs and pianos. Yeah. But this is a pretty big intro to the new guy.
Yep. And I was going to say, I think this song specifically sets up that classic Yes sound that you're talking about, which is Rick and Steve trading licks. And they trade a lot of licks in this song. And there's, you know, an organ solo and everything. So you're right. This really announces that Rick Wakeman is here. And I also think this song really, for me, highlights the adage about how good musicians make hard songs sound easy. Because I actually find this to be an extremely easy listen, even though there's a lot of stuff going on.
I think that has always been my beef, I guess. For those who haven't listened to the show before, I am more of a casual listener of prog. I'm not deep down in the weeds with Ian, definitely not. So I do like Yes, clarify a point I made earlier. I don't dissent against Yes in general. I kind of just dissent against their like deep back catalog. It's too much Yes, but this song is like the exact opposite of that for me. It's the best of Yes. While I was listening to it, I was like, yeah, this is probably my favorite Yes song. And yeah, it's probably because I'm that casual listener that's not deep in the weeds. But I do enjoy listening to full albums. And as a full album goes, it's a great way to start this one off.
And I was going to say there's a reason this is Prog's signature song. I mean, it's Yes's signature song, but it's the whole genre's signature song because I think it's got all the proggy features, but it's sweet medicine.
Well, while it was a hit and one of their bigger hits, I think what's kind of unique about Yes, and maybe they're fans, and I'm painting with a pretty broad brush here, but I don't think you're going to get those kind of people that are going to single out Nick and say, oh, you filthy casual, you'll name one song besides Roundabout. Like, oh, yeah. Like, I don't think that exists. So while it may be one of the, I don't know, mainstream pieces, anyone who is even a, you know, deeply, deeply entrenched fan, and that's not always a compliment, wouldn't fault you for saying that it's one of the greats.
I mean, and I was going to say, I think it has all of Yes's trademarks. So, you know, if you like Yes, you probably should like the song. And actually, it's funny because this is prog rock's Stairway to Heaven. Again, in this very weird, narrow genre, it is the song that made it onto the classic rock radio. It's the one that lasted the longest, you know, kind of in a posterity sense. And just like Stairway to Heaven, there's a reason, because Stairway to Heaven has all of the classic rock tropes, and this has all of the prog rock tropes. And even though I did not work at your pizza restaurant, I was not there flipping Zaz to Roundabout all night long.
As one does, flips.
That's what we call it.
I have heard this song thousands of times, and it's funny, even coming back for this podcast, listening to the song again, I'm like, oh yeah, love this song. And I think I have the same feeling with Pink Floyd's Money, where, you know, it's a classic rock staple, and as soon as, like, the bass kicks in, you're hooked. And I think it's the same with this. As soon as that, like, backwards piano and the little ding, I'm like, okay, yep, I'm ready to go on the whole journey. And I actually think that's another thing. The song really rolls quite nicely. Like, it's got a very, very powerful driving beat. So you want to go on the journey with it?
It's the opposite reaction. To most people, you now hear, like, the first first unit is A Stairway to Heaven, and most fans now are just like, ugh. I don't think there's any danger of you going to the music store and around all the keyboards, there's a sign that says no roundabout.
Well, I will slightly disagree with you, Ian, on the this is their Stairway, because I think Stairway sent Led Zeppelin to another level, like the meta jokes of Wayne's World. Also, I think the song that people know is the single that was cut down to about 3 minutes. There's no single version of Stairway. I think it has that gravitas of like, you're not cutting this song.
I actually don't know if I have heard the chopped and screwed 3 minute version.
Yeah, I don't think so either.
An abomination.
It's hard to imagine the song being 3 minutes.
No, and I think that would be the thing is like, because they're 20 minute epic Close to the Edge, they'll chop a 3 minute single out of that too. And again, obviously the bits will be fun and stuff, but without context, I'm not sure how much these are hot summer bangers. Like, they're just, you know, they're good songs.
I've developed what I call the yes test. If I check to see how much time is remaining on the song, that means the song is not for me. And
well, it's a classic. Okay. It's like checking your watch during a movie. That means not so good.
Nick, I have a similar rule in prog rock. Slightly different, though. Sometimes in these long songs, they go on so long and go through different phases. And sometimes the song gets so quiet, I'm worried like Spotify turned off. And I'm like, is it still playing? Oh, it is.
Am I still here?
Yeah. I'm terrified on this musical podcast that we have to talk about the music itself. But I think there's a lot of sounds that shouldn't work together in this song, but they all kind of come together in the way that only Yes can do it.
Yeah.
Am I right in describing, are these power chords?
You're not far off. So Steve Howe famously doesn't really play power chords, but actually this is the closest he plays to power chords because he does that do, 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 do. They are the closest he ever plays to, that's his smoke on the water moment. And for the people who care, he's playing a kind of harmonics where he's going bling, 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 bling. And then down at the bottom, he's doing a power chordy thing, I think. But the sound you're really hearing is Chris Squire's bass.
Mm.
Yeah, that's where all the chonk comes from.
And this isn't the only song that's like that either. There's a lot of chonking. He is up in the mix quite loudly.
But I think you mix that with a lot of like bells in the percussion and a lot of, like the futuristic keyboards. It kind of sounds like some kids that are all trying out their new instrument, but it really does work.
No, you're 100% right. This is the Taster song on a Taster album. Because you have the, you know, intro acoustic, you've got the organ, you've got, as you say, the crazy keyboards. Like, there's a bit for everyone.
Yeah, the intro, it's something that's really fun to play. And I like to play it to check to see if my guitar's in tune. Because I think it uses every string.
I mean, funnily enough, Steve Howe will perfect this in the intro on the next album will just be him literally tuning up. So he takes the idea forward.
This is what everyone wants to hear.
And you know what? We did. We did want to hear it. That's the reason we're doing this podcast. So we then arrive at Cons und Proms. So Bill Bruford would suggest that each member of the band conduct the band, quote unquote, in 5 solo pieces that would be spread throughout the album. And this is the first, though it's not technically a band piece. So Rick Wakeman, the new kid, could not compose songs for contractual reasons. He was on a different record label. So this song is a stitched together version of some Brahms, Johannes Brahms songs. So I'd say for me, this is a fair enough intro to Rick Wakeman's abilities and whatnot. And it's short and pleasant enough that though it's not my favorite Yes song they ever made, I basically don't skip it because it's 2 minutes. By the time I'm pressing skip, it's over.
I'm with you where I have fun every time. It's I hate to call it filler, but
yeah,
it is, I think. Yeah. But it works. It serves as a break in between songs, and it's fun to listen to. I guess my question is, why is it Cans and Brahms? Where does that come from?
I have absolutely no idea. I really don't know. I was thinking maybe Cans, like studio headphones, the Cans. But then I was also like, so I always say Kanz und Brahms is how I always say the name, but that's ridiculous. That's a name. That's a pronunciation I've completely made up. I don't actually know if he's Brahms or Brahms. So Kams and Brahms.
I'm going to take a massive guess here. In music, a canon is a contrapuntal compositional technique that employs a melody with one or more imitations of the melody played after a given duration.
Holy guacamole, you might not be wrong.
Actually, yeah.
See, our very own Dan Brown cracking those cases.
Contrapuntal is the word of the day.
Because that means using counterpoint, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Does everyone know this but me? God.
Come on, core curriculum, Brian.
No, not at all. I have never looked that up, Brian. And the reason that's remarkable is that sounds very plausible here.
Ian, the backstory that you covered earlier about why he couldn't compose his own music honestly explains one of the thoughts I had about the song, which is it's shockingly not indulgent for, you know, the new kid. He didn't want to go too big, too hard, and had to hold himself back a little bit. But that makes sense. I think it's fun. I don't skip it, but I don't have a ton else to say about it.
I think it would have been fun for one of the others to compose a song for him to play, you know, so that it could have been a kind of like an original song.
I think Rick, though, would have an issue doing something short and sweet. I think if he had his own way, it would be like a 19-minute song about Queen Boudicca set to figure skating or something.
Yeah. Well, and this is he saved all that chi for his albums.
Like, yes.
I guess my only additional comment on this song is I can deal with the song as being part of the album, even though it is quite different from the rest. I just question whether it should have been second in the track order, because it's immediately throwing a curveball. While Roundabout just set you up for like, oh, my expectations are super high, to something that is entirely different from what the band usually and classically does. So I think that was a mistake.
Yeah.
But I'm always making comments about the track order. So
I think that was part of the sandwich aspect of this album, where, as I said, there's like three actual elements and then the rest are various cheeses and pickles and maybe some sauces, where they are fun, weird tastes, and maybe the whole album hangs together. I don't know. But it's not the divine architecture of Dark Side of the Moon. This is definitely a tapas album where you're doing a little bit of tasting around the way.
For me, it's like, to go with your metaphor, it's like you ordered a burger, but the first thing you bite into is a whole carrot. You're like, what the hell is this doing in here?
Well, that's actually, Nick, I like that, because it wouldn't be bad. You'd just be angry. Like, it doesn't taste bad, but you'd be like, this is not what I wanted.
You would be confused, yeah.
It's like the first bite. You're like, oh, what? This is weird.
Oh, fabulous.
I just have a delightful mental image of Nick eating this burger.
Well, so the next part of the burger, I guess, I don't know if this is like the capers or something. I don't know what we put in this burger. But we have Heaven. So this is John Anderson's vocal piece. So basically it's just a nice little vocal chant over some light drums. And again, pleasant enough solo song. And all I really have to say about this, if you loved this song, John Anderson is going to be doing this whole album in 3 years' time, Elias of Sun Hilo. So it is nice for me to hear what a non-musician does without the sonic support of four absolutely genius virtuoso musicians. Because obviously John has a very fertile musical mind. He's the primary songwriter. And it was fun just to hear him alone in the studio do his thing.
It's absolutely delightful. The little round he gets going, it's just this uplifting sound that no one else is capable of in the whole band. And it's funny you mentioned that it's basically him working by himself. It's interesting you called him a non-musician, though. I mean, he did know how to play a couple instruments. But yeah, I'm curious, when you say he's a non-musician, are you simply just comparing him to everyone else?
Oh, yeah. To be fair, we are all non-musicians when compared to Steve Allen and Rick Wakeman. But I mean, yeah. I think there is an element of John Anderson can, in fact, play percussion, guitar, piano. Like, he can play these things. I just get the sense that he can plot out some chords. And maybe non-musician's not the word for him, but definitely not the rest of Yes. He's a normal guy when it comes to his hands. And so it's fun to hear him without them. It's a fun context.
Is this song just one chord?
You know, I don't know. Because, like, it builds. I don't know if it's one chord, but it does, because it, and maybe it's different voicings of one chord.
Because I, like Ryan, very much agree that John Anderson is the ray of sunshine in the band. Most of the uplifting parts, you can tell it's his influence. I think he gives the band, like, a little bit more heart. You know?
Yeah.
A bunch of cold musicians just honing their craft after years and years and years. And then John Anderson's just like, hey guys, why not have some fun? And then he comes up with fun little developments like this.
I think it's what King Crimson is missing and what ELP needed more of.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's true.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Because ELP had it. I just don't think they took advantage enough of Greg Lake as they should have.
It neither did King Crimson. they needed to take advantage of Greg Lake as
yeah.
well. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I completely agree with you. And I think, actually, this is the interesting thing about Yes, is I can't think of another band that's so aggressively positive and so effortlessly positive as well. Like, and maybe it's John Anderson's influence that he's a little ray of sunshine sprinkling over everyone. It's funny, my wife always said he just crawled out of a bluebell one day. Just a little pixie John Anderson. Tee-hee. So next we go to the gabagool of this delicious sandwich, South Side of the Sky. So this is a song apparently about, I don't know, Arctic explorers dying, something to do with that. We don't really know. But what I will say is this song highlights two things. The first is I think this has some of Yes's lightness as a band, because I think this song, especially Bill Bruford, really does his jazzy drum thing where he's playing a lot of like fancy ride things and light little kind of like tom fills and stuff. And I think this is also helped by, you know, Rick Wakeman and Steve not just playing like big blocky chords. They kind of go dee-dee-dee-dee-doo. So, yeah, I find this to be both an angular song, it is pretty heavy, but also a light song. And then we'll come to the vocal bit in a bit. But any thoughts initially about South Side of the Sky?
I think this song rules. Big yeah. fan. I think it's maybe Yes's biggest rockin' moment. I mean, it's heavy, it's fun. I like the, you know, maybe like the mountain climbing metaphor. It climbs up, it goes down, it climbs back up. It's very yeah. fun. And if you listen to a lot of Yes Live, John does something which I wish, you know, he did before maybe all the songs. He just told you what the song's about. And he's, because he usually says something to the effect of, this song is about climbing mountains. It's dangerous. But we all must climb mountains every day. And he says nice. That almost word for word before this,
yeah.
before playing this live. So he maybe should do that more often.
yeah. So this song as well, with all of its little bits all chopped around. So Steve Howe said about this album, Fragile was recorded more as a piece of production as opposed to a band going in and playing live. We constructed tempo, drum parts, keyboards. And when the verses came, when the choruses came, when this all happened, it was a beautiful thing. And we did benefit from having a production mindset at this point. And I guess this is the Yes album has this a little bit, but this album's really the first of their Frankenstein albums. And boy, oh boy, do they Frankenstein some albums. So they really stitched together all the bits. I still think it sounds really flowy and natural. I don't think, and you know, that's, I guess what he's getting at is it is amazing that they slapped all of these bits together and these songs sound so natural.
So it's funny that it works so well and that they did. I mean, these songs show up in their set lists a decent amount later on live. So it still translated to a band playing live, even though if it was put together as a mishmash of clips and bits.
You know, I feel like it was John Anderson even said that they had to go back and learn how to play their own songs. Because, and I was going to say, I think there's honestly nothing too jarring about the transitions to all the different parts of Yes. And it's funny, like with South Side of the Sky, when the piano part kicks in, the beginning's really ragey and rocky. When the piano part kicks in, I'm not like, oh my God, what have you done? And then when it kicks back out, back to the kind of, you know, aggressive fade out, again, I'm not like, this is so shocking. I think they had enough compositional wherewithal to make it a very smooth arc.
A lot of bands, they all have at least that one song, or even sometimes a whole album's like, oh yeah, we don't play that one live.
Yeah.
But yeah, this doesn't seem to fall victim to that.
So the other kind of big part about this song is the vocal piano breakdown in the middle. So I don't think Yes ever really do this again, but that's to me what makes this a great song. So in the middle, they break down. Rick Wakeman apparently composed this part, but obviously couldn't take the composer's credit for it. He plays some piano and they all go na 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 over it. And I was looking back on my life. I was reminiscing and I was like, actually, na na na's in songs are very, very hard to do and to be interesting. And there's a handful of ones that then make the grade. So, you know, like the end of Hey Jude or something. But it's very hard to do because you can't rely on a recognizable melody or lyric. You just have to have a nice voice. And so all three, so Steve, Chris, and John together going na 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 na, beautifully and melodically, harmonically, just sounds so good. That part just delights me greatly.
Well, it's not kind of the straight up pop na 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 you'd expect, though. It's still very jazzy. That melody is still a bit weird.
Yeah.
When I hear it in my head and my mind's ears, like I can still hear Anne's vocal jazz group doing this. They never did. I wish they did. But like I can easily imagine that.
Yeah.
And I think that's why it is part of the gabagool, right? It's not.
It is the gabagool.
It's not your everyday just. It's not just a slice of bologna. There's some spice to it.
So I don't have any comments on the na-na-na's part, although I will agree with you, Ian, that's really hard to pull off and not have it be cheesy and also not have it be like an anthem, because that's very different from an anthem. Mm-hmm. But I do have comment on the awesome riffage that's in the majority of this song. The riffs reminds me of like maybe this was the twinkle in Rush's eye, you know, because it's not super clean.
Mm.
It makes some interesting steps. That's not super
like obvious.
Yeah. Not super obvious.
I can definitely see where Rush would take, you know, this musical lineage basically. And in fact, it was Rush who inducted Yes into the Musical Hall of Fame. So there you go. Hearts all around.
I did not know that.
There you go. Yeah.
When was that?
2015, 16, 17, something like
that.
Wow,
that feels super late.
I mean, the world just needed to recognize Yes eventually. They caught up to us. So that will be it for today. We will see you guys next week for part two of Fragile. Thank you, Nick.
Thanks, Ian.
Thank you, Ryan.
Thank you, Ian.
Thank you, Brian.
Always a pleasure.
I have been your host, Ian Prize, and this has been A Sort of Young Person's Guide to Prog Rock. Hello, hello. Just quickly before you go, this is I, your humble host, Ian. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in for season two. And I just wanted to let you know we're going to be doing a mailbag episode in a little bit. So do get all of your hot takes, spicy opinions, etc., etc. Send them over to us at helloprogfrog@gmail.com. Thank you so much, and we'll see you again very soon for part two.